One of the first disciplinary cases that came out was actually in Oregon, way back in 2000, in Rigotti, where a different case, where a different scenario came about. And this was a medical practitioner, and they were posing as people who wanted to get a job there to try to figure out things that couldn't have been obtained in any other way. And in that case, they said, this is a violation of the rule. But what they were afraid of is, do we need some sort of safe harbor for governmental prosecutions or governmental investigations? I mean, can we have this rule that says any pretexting by you, attorney, or facilitated by another on behalf of the attorney is going to violate the rule? And they said, there are scenarios where we need to do this. And so they actually amended their ethics rules to provide this safe harbor for attorneys or those people that they supervise or that they contract with to do investigations to be allowed to engage in certain covert activity in certain very limited scope issues. Two great places to see sort of where the states stand on this, the various ethics opinions across the state, are two, and I didn't include them in your materials, but I wanted to mention them here too because they're great, bullet-pointed, short read, you know, too much to read, but that you can see the national survey of where states stand. One of them is by Catherine Fenton of Jones Day, and it's called Ethical Complications of Lawyer Pretexting and Instructing Others. And then actually, one of your sponsors here, Foley and Lardner, has a whole chapter on pretexting. It's chapter 13, and it's available online as well, that goes into detail actually explaining the limited scope of where it may be allowed, where it might be, how far is too far, what deception is allowed and what is not, and how you can still be in compliance with the rules of professional conduct even though you're engaging in this activity. And the other thing I want to mention here is when we're citing these rules, we're citing the model rules of professional conduct. Certainly, across the jurisdictions, they vary widely, particularly when we're talking about the conflicts rules as well as 1.6, the confidentiality rules. And I always say, be very mindful of what not only your state's rules are, but the state in which you may have a case or the state where the issue arises, because it can make a huge difference. And it can make a huge difference to you not knowing those should you ever have to come before a regulatory body.
Yeah, great, great points. I just looked at Texas confidentiality today. It's a very different arrangement than the model rule on confidentiality. But I was impressed, thought it did a good job. So let's look at the rules on this particular scenario. And as we note here, all of these are two model rules. So if you're practicing in Texas, then you will want to find the counterpart. And Texas is organized similarly to the model rules, but with a few differences. So we've already hit Rule 1.7a, concurrent or current conflict of interest based on obligations to another. And 1.6a, to me, the issues here that stand out in dramatic profile are the issue of false statement. And why is that? Well, because of the line in the scenario that, I mean, it gives us the conclusion these are deceptive interactions. So there's some kind of dishonesty going on. And to bring that home from the investigator who's actually engaged in the conduct back to the lawyer, I think the important thing here is the 5.3 professional liability potentially for the acts of others. And, of course, in common law as well, if there is some kind of cause of action against the investigator and you are serving, or the person in the scenario is serving as the lawyer, the idea of saying, well, I'm a mere conduit, is not probably very forceful in court. It almost has a pretextual ring to it from the beginning. Also, 4.1 and 8.4c, which relates to dishonesty, fraud, and deceit. And then we don't know this for sure, but 4.4, sort of we're reading into it a little bit, the idea that if the opposition research does bring forward information about these individuals who are accusing CEO, then was this a method designed to harass those individuals and to prevent them from bringing a lawsuit? There may be other points on this one. It's a pretty textured problem. Anybody else?